Welcome to my monthly podcast titled Becoming a Sage. My name is Jan Fried, but you can call me Dr. Jan. I blog about leading, living, and saging, or positive aging. I am passionate about helping people get from where they are to where they want to be, particularly in the second half of life. I also say I'm out to retire the word retirement. We are not retiring, but moving on to something else. And I believe it takes time and intentional thought to successfully move on to what's next in life. Today, I'm interviewing Chip Conley. As a rebel, hospitality entrepreneur, and New York Times bestselling author, Chip Conley is a leader at the forefront of the sharing economy. At age 26, he founded Joie de Vivre Hospitality, transforming one inner city model into the second largest boutique hotel brand in America. After running his company as CEO for 24 years, he sold it, and soon the young founders of Airbnb asked him to help transform their promising startup into the world's leading hospitality brand. Chip served as Airbnb's head of global hospitality and strategy for 4 years and today acts as the company's strategic advisor for hospitality and leadership. After reading Chip's new book, Wisdom at Work, The Making of a Modern Elder, which just came out in September, I knew I wanted to interview him for my podcast series. Chip shares his experiences as both mentor and unexpected intern at Airbnb, and what he learned and shares in the book is consistent with what I have learned about becoming a sage. For more information on Chip, please refer to the bio attached to this podcast. Welcome to the series, Chip.
Oh, it's an honor to be with you. Thank you very much.
Yes. Well, I was so excited when you accepted my offer to be interviewed because I absolutely loved your book and blew through it and wanted to underline like every sentence. Just have a few questions and we're going to learn more about this. So what is Wisdom at Work? What is this book all about?
Well, it captures my experience at Airbnb as a 52-year-old. I'm now 58, so this is 6 years ago when I started with them. I was a 52-year-old who had a long history as a boutique hotelier, as you said, and all of a sudden I found myself in the land of the young. I was this is this little tech startup that had a hospitality and travel focus, but no one in the company had any travel or hospitality industry background. And so the young founders invited me to join them to be the mentor, in-house mentor to Brian Chesky, the CEO and co-founder, as well as to be the head of global hospitality and strategy. So the book is really the story, it's much more than, as you know, much more than just my story, mm-hmm. but it's the story of what it's like to reinvent yourself or to repurpose yourself in midlife in a whole new environment and how awkward that can be at times. As well as how beautiful and enlightening it can be. And that's one of the key messages of the book is that there's a certain amount of moving from your safe harbor you have to do if you're going to remake yourself and repurpose yourself in midlife.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know it came out of your experiences and again, I like your resources. I mean, there were several things I learned in the book, but what inspired you to write the book? Why the book? It's one thing to have the life experience, but why did you write the book?
You know, this is my fifth book, so the idea of writing a book is not new for me.
Sure.
I really enjoy it, and it helps me to make sense of the wisdom that I've learned along the way. The reason I felt the need to write this particular book was because a growing number of my friends who are in their anywhere from mid-40s to mid-60s have expressed their sense of feeling more and more irrelevant in an era. So, you know, we're all going to live maybe 10 or 15 years longer than our parents, and yet power seems to be moving 10 or 15 years younger. And if that's true, we've created a new irrelevancy gap for people in midlife. And so I wanted to take a stab at writing a book that helped people to understand how to stay relevant, you know, at a time when, frankly, it feels like all the power is moving to the millennials.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a very good point. Well, I love the term that you've used in the book and, you know, even in the subtitle, modern elder. Define what is a modern elder? How are you using that term?
Yeah. Well, it came from the idea. First of all, there's a difference between an elder and being an elderly person.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And elderly is usually what you are in the last 10 years of your life, maybe. you tend to be a little bit, at whatever age you're going to potentially pass away, those are the years where you're seriously in need and support of other people. And you're not quite as vibrant and active in the world. But there's a period of life as we live longer, which is this extended midlife, mm-hmm. where people are very active, still fully capable of operating in the workplace. And yet more and more we seem to be put out to pasture way too early. And to me, the word elder is just reclaiming a word, but giving it a new spin by calling it a modern elder. The elder of the past was regarded for their reverence. You sort of revered your elders because of obligation or because of historical wisdom they might have. But today it's not about reverence, it's about relevance. And relevance means that someone who's a little older, and when you're an elder, you could be a 40-year-old and be an elder if you're surrounded by 25-year-olds. So it's just a relative term to the people who are around you. I was 52 and the average age at Airbnb was 26, so I was absolutely an elder. And what it means is that you are appreciated not just for your wisdom, but for your curiosity. And so I felt I was as much an intern as I was a mentor. Mm-hmm. And that helped me at Airbnb to be both the intern at times in asking very naive questions in meetings about tech questions, because I was not used to the tech world, but also to mentor people privately. So I interned publicly and I mentored privately. And I think people appreciated the fact that instead of trying to be the know-it-all, I was the one who would ask a lot of questions.
Well, I think that's a great, and you even, in your book, I don't know if you created this term, but is it mentorn?
Yes, where you're combining
mentor and intern, mentorn. And I like that spin on it very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was very good. Why is ageism, which is a, you know, I just wrote an article about age being the unconscious bias, you know, that we don't realize that we are falling into what society, you know, is enamored with the youth. So why is ageism the last socially acceptable bias?
I think it's partly because there's a sense that the people who are older had their chance. Whereas for women or people of color or LGBT folks, there's an element that those people have never had the power. So it's now important to create a meritocratic society where people, you know, who are the other, so to speak, are able to have power. But for older people, there's a sense of like, hey, you already had your chance to have power, move on. And so ageism is maybe a little bit of the sense of like, hey, you know, there's a sort of a zero-sum power scenario here. And if old people continue to hold on to power, young people won't have it. I think that's like sort of a silly thought, because I think, frankly, old people and young people can learn from each other, and then the power is just better for everybody.
Right.
But I think some of it's also based upon stereotypes that are actually really either no longer true or were never true. And think some of those stereotypes relate to older people maybe not being as collaborative, or getting more sick, or not being as committed to the job, or not being able to learn and be confident about technology, or they're more expensive because they've just been around longer and you have to pay them more. So I could go through in chapter 9, I go through each one of those and I say, you know, here's the evidence to the contrary. But some of those stereotypes influence, you know, HR departments and recruiting teams as to who they're going to hire.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. Well, I know I have some friends looking, you know, would love to switch jobs, have a lot to offer, and really feel that age has been a problem. So, you know, overcoming that is really, I think, important. Because like you said, that intergenerational learning is critical. Would you say that wisdom at work is just for people in midlife?
Not necessarily. I mean, the book is certainly for, I first of all, let's define midlife. Midlife to me has historically been 45 to 65, and I actually would suggest that it's 35 to 75. Mm-hmm. So what was a crisis, midlife crisis, that term coined in 1965, is now a marathon.
we've turned
a crisis into a marathon, and it's I think from 35 to 75, because there are a lot of people in certain industries, tech industry, advertising industry, entertainment industry, who start feeling irrelevant in their mid-30s. And there are a lot of people who will work by choice or by requirement, they'll work into their mid-70s, because in some cases they can't afford not to, especially if they're going to live to age 100. So long story short is I believe that anybody in 35 to 75 could find this book helpful. Beyond that, I do find that young people are gravitating to the book because for two reasons. One is they want to figure out how to find a modern elder or a mentor, and they want to understand the psychology of people in midlife so they could actually tap into them. And in some cases, they're reading it partly because they see this as a future. This is their future. They'd like to see the path of how they can aspire to be wise, how they can be more wise as they grow older. And the book is really very much about cultivating and harvesting wisdom.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I find that very interesting because that's reinforcing. I had a leadership book come out in 2013 where I interviewed more than 100 what I called sages. It's called Leading with Wisdom, Sage Advice from 100 Experts. And as I was collecting and doing the research, I was also teaching an undergraduate leadership course to typical 20 to 22-year-olds, and they absolutely loved it. And so I think what I think is the earlier people understand these messages and learn how to live a more purposeful life, the better off they are. So I found that interesting too.
Great.
It isn't just for, you know, older people. So, interesting. Well, how can boomers, you know, you had that work experience, and how can boomers and millennials better understand and support each other based on your work and life experiences?
Well, I think that Gen Xers in between as well are important to not to be forgotten.
Yeah.
This is a very rough idea, and so it doesn't apply to everybody, but I think it applies very much to many people. I think as we get older, we are more emotionally intelligent. There's a lot of truth to that. There's a lot of evidence of that. So your EQ can grow with the age. On the other hand, there's something that I call DQ, digital intelligence. And digital intelligence means you understand technology tools, but you also understand how it is evolving in our lives. And younger people, millennials specifically, are really good at that. So I think the thing that we can learn is to imagine that this is an intergenerational potluck, and we can share, in essence, what we know best across generations. And so often it's a millennial and Gen Q, Gen X EQ that they can actually share with millennials, and millennials can share the DQ with the older people, and both are better off as a result of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I actually cite you in that article I wrote about unconscious bias from your Harvard Business Review article.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yeah, that was excellent. So, and I liked how you said something about, I don't remember the exact quote, but, meaning boomers, don't have an expiration date like a milk carton, but we're more like fine wine or something. You use very good metaphors. I like that very much.
Thank you.
Well, as I was reading your book, I was very fascinated with what you're creating in this Modern Elder Academy. Can you explain that and describe that? And some of our listeners might be very interested in attending that or knowing more about that.
Sure. So as I was writing Wisdom at Work, I was interviewing 150 people in midlife, and I could feel the growing anxiety and bewilderment for a lot of people. Anxiety about if they're going to live to age 90 or 100, how do they pay for this? And the bewilderment that the way things have been done in work that they've been so used to has changed so much. And so I started to think about the fact that we don't really have a midlife wisdom school where a person goes and sort of like taps into their mastery and their wisdom that they've learned over the years and then applies it elsewhere. And, you know, that idea of navigating midlife transitions is something we just frankly have been very absent as a society in trying to solve. So I decided, you know, I live part of the year down in a place called Baja California, which is it's Baja California Sur, which is the southern part of Baja. Mm-hmm. It's Mexico, just below U.S. Part of the, like, just below San Diego, but way down at the tip where Cabo San Lucas is. Mm-hmm. We're about an hour north of that on the Pacific Ocean side. And so the Modern Elder Academy is a 3-acre campus with housing, and it's like a boutique hotel right on the beach. And people come for a Sunday to Sunday program to actually understand the principles in the book and apply them to their own lives. And so it's been very successful. And half of the people are on scholarship, so it's a social enterprise, sort of like a nonprofit. Mm-hmm. And this last week we had a cohort with just 12 people in it, but from 5 different countries. So most of the cohorts are 12 to 18 people.
Wow. And who are the, I mean, like, who helps you with this? Like, the reason why I'm asking is because I was just at a conference and I've interviewed Dr. Bill Thomas before.
Yeah, I love him.
Yeah, he's been on my podcast, and I think he mentioned you, and so mentioned your work. So I didn't know if he's helping you or anyway.
He's certainly in my book, and he has been somebody I have reached out to for wisdom over the years. So he's helpful. In terms of who comes, it's people generally who are in a transitional time in their life. Let's recognize that transitions in midlife are, we have so many of them. You could have parents die. You could have a spouse die. You could get divorced. You could change your job or your career or where you live. You could have empty nest syndrome with all of your kids gone. You can have menopause. You can have the male version of that, which is called andropause. You could have a diagnosis of an illness or disease that's very serious. So all those things happen in midlife, and yet we don't really have anything. Like, we have, you know, we have in puberty, you have bat mitzvahs, bar mitzvahs, quinceañeras. When you graduate from adolescence to adulthood, you have a commencement exercise and you're graduating. But we don't really do much in midlife to help people understand how do you get through these transitional times. And that's part of why people come. I would say the lens that many people have is in their career, because my book is very career focused. Mm-hmm. But people come for all kinds of reasons. And it's definitely a vulnerable space that people sort of get into, and the connection that they have with their fellow people in their cohort is quite deep.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is very fascinating. What do you hope the book will bring about, besides maybe introducing people to your academy, or what else is on your agenda? What else are you planning to do with this information? Because I'm also very passionate about, clearly, this topic and helping people become elders, not just older.
Yeah. Well, I think it really comes down to the idea that there's a societal need. And I think the societal need is that we need to figure out how to create intergenerational collaboration like never before, since we have 5 generations in the workplace at the same time. So I think it serves the society well to figure out how do we not operate like isolationist countries, but instead figure out how to create a trade agreement across our borders, generational borders. And then it's also something I feel a commitment to my own generation, to people I know who are getting depressed in their 50s because they feel like nobody wants to listen to them anymore, and no one wants to, frankly, learn from them. But the number one piece of advice I give to people who are in that state is, like, maybe you're supposed to listen to someone else. Maybe you're supposed to learn from someone else. Just because you're 55 years old doesn't mean that your learning in life is over. In fact, it may be just starting in all kinds of new ways. And so I think helping people to see that curiosity, you can be both curious and wise at the same time, is I think, the way we will think of people in midlife and later in the future.
I would totally agree. In fact, I think our timing is perfect, because even you're seeing more and more movies targeted about this topic for this audience, these generations. The Intern is just an easy one to come up with, but whether it's Bucket List or all kinds of movies are trying to show people being wise and curious at the same time. So I think that's very good. Well, our time is kind of coming to an end, and I always like to, you know, allow the interviewee, what else should I have asked you? What else would you want to share with our listeners? What else do you think they should know about this topic that I didn't ask?
You know, I think the number one thing I'd say is that the idea of a three-stage life is really evaporating, which is you learn till you're 20 or 25, you earn till you're 65, and then you retire till you die. That model is pretty much falling apart, and millennials don't believe in it. And I think more and more people in midlife are feeling the same way, which means that you can look at how do you become a lifelong learner, or how do you even take a sabbatical or a gap year in the middle of your life to reimagine yourself. And so it means that people are going to actually go through, instead of sort of having this more linear path that we've traditionally had, you're going to go through phases of your life. And during certain phases, you're going to have a certain approach to how you're operating your life. And I think it makes for a more interesting life. And I think that's really our future.
Yep, I couldn't agree more. Well, thank you very much, Chip. And I'll let you know when we post this interview. I appreciate it very much. And again, my goal is to help people make the rest of life the best of life. So thank you very much.
Great. Thank you. Really appreciate it, Jen.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.